Meredith Jaffe, welcome to Booktopia. It's great to have you here with your book, The Fence.
It's such a pleasure to be here, Caro. Thank you for having me.
Well, I have to start by asking you, given the subject matter of the book, have you ever had a neighbourly dispute? Because you write about it with such feeling and accuracy that I thought, Jesus, is this my life? Or has Meredith had the same experience as me?
Well, somebody actually tweeted back to me, a publisher tweeted back to me, she goes, your art is my life. Of course I have. I mean, it's funny, like the character Gwen has been with me for a really long time, and but I had no vehicle for her beyond the fact that I did want to write a suburban drama, even though everyone tells you not to write a suburban drama.
Why?
Well, because, you know, domestic is dull kind of thing.
But and, look what it's done for Leanne Moriarty. Yeah, well, excuse me.
Exactly. She is the past mistress of domestic noir. Anyway, and then we had our old neighbours sold up. And we had new neighbours move in. They had a young child. They were moving from an apartment to their first ever house. And they were madly renovating, etc., from the moment they moved in. And then they were like, we want to put up a fence. And we kind of always expected there would be a fence. We weren't stupid, even though there never had been one. But what struck me was the sort of single-minded way they went around about that, and their shock and horror that people may have a different opinion to themselves on, you know, what should constitute a fence. And rather, initially, of course, my reaction was to be very sort of upset and anxious because these people were being, you know, so rude and things were, you know, let's just say that neither side of the fence, you know, perhaps conducted themselves in the most dignified fashion at all times. But I was sitting there looking through my picture window into their lounge room one day, and I went, this is really silly. I don't know why people are so upset about fences, but maybe I now have found my vehicle for Gwen.
Fantastic. I mean, what a great thing to be able to put your experience into a novel and make that your revenge,
yes,
in a way.
Yes.
I mean, it's therapeutic. It's been cathartic, presumably.
It's been very cathartic, but equally, I really was quite struck by the fact that fences assume a much larger role in our minds than they do as a physical thing.
You know? Do they ever?
I know, and when you think about it, it's so damn obvious. You've got the Great Wall of China, you've got the Iron Curtain, I mean, precisely, you know, the Americans are proposing their Mexican border wall, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And, but history has also shown us that they don't solve the problem. And so really, it should have been a no-brainer, but I really enjoyed the process of dividing up the argument and going, well, why would you think one thing and not another? Mm. And of course, like all novelists, the autobiographical morphs into the fictional what-ifs. So yeah, it's a starting point, it's not an ending point.
Well, I want to talk about Gwen in a moment because she is so fabulous, but I do note that since your dispute with your particular neighbours, you have moved. So in a sense, was that a surrender? You just couldn't stand being there anymore? Or did you move for other reasons?
Fortunately, we were already in the process of wanting to move by the time these people came into our lives. Although I'm sure that they probably feel that they were victorious because we did move. And it's ironic also because where we now live, and we live on 50 acres in the country, fences have a very different meaning where,
yes,
we now live. They're about containing animals and keeping out predators, etc., etc. So, and the neighbours are very different when you're talking across kilometres of boundary rather than when you're talking in that very intense suburban space.
Absolutely, where every centimetre is kind of contested and every,
yes,
primula that's been planted that could be pulled up is, you know, the possible sort of vehicle for vexation. Now, you say that in a way Gwen is a creation who, in a sense, is a kind of alter ego for you and your frustration with your neighbours. You've made her older than you are. She's a much more mature woman. And in fact, I was thinking about how her name dates her in a way and how we never meet anybody called Gwen anymore. How did you decide that you would make her this green-fingered, keen gardener with a column about gardening?
I knew that Gwen was a keen gardener from the moment Gwen popped into my head. She was one of those characters. I know it's a cliche, but she did pop into my head fully formed. Eric, on the other hand, was already dead when I first imagined Gwen.
So that's her husband.
And he came, sort of that evolved later. But she had a very distinctive voice and a very distinctive personality from day one. She was based on my stepmother's mother, who was absolutely a top gardener in the northern suburbs of Sydney, and was a real character. So that was sort of the foundation for her. So I guess, yeah, that was just it from day one.
And what you've done with the narrative is you've interspersed some of Gwen's columns into the narrative. And I was just wondering, are we supposed to sort of deduce that there's a kind of subtext to her gardening tips, and that her gardening tips are really about how to deal with these pesky neighbours?
Absolutely, I think. But also, when I was researching it, because I'm actually not a green thumb at all.
I didn't think you were.
No, I'm not. I'd love to be. I'm so envious of people who can create life like that, or sustain life, perhaps, for those of us who kill every pot plant we ever get. But I read masses and masses of gardening magazines and books on Gardening Australia and all those kind of things. And the thing that struck me, the common element to all of those different media was, or is, these incredibly passionate, upbeat nature of gardening columnists and gardening presenters. And I love the difference between Gwen as a columnist, which is very peppy and full of great advice and involve the grandkids and, you know, coax life into this, and what she was like as a real person. And I love the fact that Gwen seems to be oblivious to the fact that she is unlike the seasons and the garden that evolves and change, she is in fact entrenched in her position. Mm. So while she's busy giving everyone advice, saying, you know, must move and now's the time to plant bulbs or whatever the case may be, she's actually intractable. And she never thinks of herself like that, and yet she isn't changing with the seasons at all.
So she's not flexible, really, is she?
No.
But it has to be said that the family that move in on the other side of her, so where she used to have a beloved neighbour, now there's this new family, the de Marchaliers. I kind of sense that slightly foreign, slightly French name has suggestions of pretension about it. Mm. It's sort of like you're sort of red flagging the fact that they are not going to be easy. So tell us about this family, who they are, and the attitude that they come with.
Well, of course, Frankie, or Francesca de Marchaliers, has trying to solve a marital problem, and that is her husband's infidelity. And on very bad advice from her mother, Noelle, she believes that if she whisks him off to the leafy suburbia, that will somehow, by removing him from temptation, that will somehow solve the problem, which, of course, life is not like that. I think that Francesca's biggest problem, well, she has a terrible relationship with her mother. She's a very much put-upon eldest child. She's a career woman who takes her career very seriously and also sees it as a way of avoiding motherhood to a large extent. She feels that she's the vanguard of the New World Order because, unlike most women who work, she has a house husband, and that supposedly is going to solve everything as well. But of course it doesn't, because he's a house husband, not a housewife. And she feels the less in control she feels about the things around her, her career, her husband, her children, the more she tries to control everything. Mm. And I think ultimately that is Francesca's biggest problem, that under pressure, under stress, she becomes a control freak, and that only makes things worse for her. And then, of course, she behaves in ways that are not perhaps shining the best light on herself.
No, I characterised her as the species Hortus domesticus nastius, because she is prepared to play quite dirty. So even though there is mediation, she also has some quite nasty moves up her sleeve. I found her a bit of a monster, I have to say. Did you have fun creating her as a monster, or were you trying to elicit some sympathy for her point of view?
I think that there is a lot of women who, of that generation, so she's in her 30s, four young children at that time, that want to have it all and feel that they can have it all, and probably need a tap on the shoulder to remind them that, yes, you can have it all, but not necessarily all at the same time.
And maybe what you need when you realise you can't have it all is a sense of humour.
Yes, exactly. She doesn't have a sense of humour at all. I enjoyed embracing all the things about being a mum and being a modern woman that are either nonsensical or difficult or, to my mind, quite amusing. So she does embody kind of all those worst traits. I'm pretty unforgiving on her in that respect. But unlike a lot of readers who feel viscerally that they hate Frankie, I actually feel really sorry for her. I think, you know, I'm always putting her in these terrible situations where she behaves appallingly and thinking, come on, wake up to yourself, wake up to yourself. But like most of us, we only really wake up to ourselves when we have to. We change because we have to, not because we might want to be a tidier person, a nicer person, a funnier person, I don't know, a person who eats less chocolate. But realistically, none of us really do change until we're forced to.
That's absolutely true. Now, there's a very poignant and tender side as well to the book, which is the relationship between Gwen and Eric. And Eric is aging with a certain amount of deterioration and confusion, so you're suggesting dementia. He decides that he's going to invest his energy in a snail farm, but he also makes beautiful dolls' houses which attract the little girls from the de Marchelier side of the fence. So you wanted to tackle a serious subject there, which is aging and dementia.
Yes, and I think that's, as we all get older, and I'm certainly on the correct side of my life to be able to start thinking about these kind of issues, I think of all the illnesses that you can get, to lose your mind is probably the cruelest. It's perhaps less cruel on you because you don't know that you've lost your mind than it is upon those who are around you. And that awfulness when I've gone with friends who have lost a parent to dementia is that they have lost them twice over. They lose them when they look at you and go, I don't know who you are, or they confuse you with their dead mother or whatever. And they lose them again when there's that kind of the final, you know, sort of final passing of that person. And even though I say that, I've also known a lot of people who work with people with dementia or have had family members with dementia who tell the most hysterical stories about what they get up to. A girlfriend of mine works in pharmacy, and you know, she has people come in and go, just retracing Eric's steps. I know he's been here because I've got the bag, but do you happen to know where he went before this? And you'll go, no. And then I go, oh, it's just that he drove the car here but walked home. You know, and some people would find that incredibly stressful and get really upset about it, and other people go, well, got the car keys, just need the car that goes with it, you know. So I really wanted to show it with some humour as well. I didn't want it just to be, oh, poor old Eric getting dementia, going downhill, and Gwen stuck with him. I actually wanted to have some of the fun with it that I've been told from various people's stories.
And there is also something very appealing and touching, I think, about the fact that the little girls love his dolls' houses and that he gets the satisfaction and the pleasure of them wanting to be in his workshop where the dolls' houses are. So I particularly enjoyed that. Well, look, Meredith, I mean, in writing this, you've obviously thought a lot about neighbours and neighbour politics. And, you know, the idea of neighbours is enshrined in popular culture in Australia. Mm-hmm. After all, the most successful soap of all time. So what are your kind of top tips for being a good neighbour now that you've written this book?
I think you do need to accommodate difference.
Should you go round straight away with, you know, a basket of goodies and introduce yourself and kind of go overboard?
Suck them in the pot.
Yeah.
I think you have to read the individuals before you do that. And I think the most insidious forms of annoying your neighbours are not necessarily things that are easy to control when you live in the suburbs or in the city, i.e. noise. You know, it's impossible to, if you want your child to be riding a skateboard up and down the driveway and there is no safe other place for them to ride and the people next door find that deeply annoying, then that is always going to be a source of friction. Loud music, people who like to mow lawns at 7 a.m. on a Sunday. I think if you can avoid the things that you know are going to upset people most of the time, and if you are going to have loud parties, if you tell people in advance that you're going to have loud parties, and they're not every weekend, of course. But I think people who behave like that in the first place are probably not considerate enough to pop in and say, by the way, it was my son's 21st on the weekend, just so you know, and this is what we've done to make it as civilised as possible. I think if people find noise pollution or whatever invasive already, I don't think you've got a lot of hope. But I think you should, like the saying goes, you should treat people how you would like to be treated yourself.
Yeah, that's the way to mend a few fences.
Yeah, it sure is.
Thank you very much, Meredith Jaffe.
Thank you for
having me. Congratulations again.
Thank you so much, Carolyn.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.